Welcome to the Mentors Podcast, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Peg Lamphere, author of Soldier, Diplomat, Archaeologist, a novel based on the bold life of Louis Palma de Cesnola, an Italian immigrant who served with honor in the American Civil War, and then, once the war was ended, became the first director of the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art. Welcome, Peg.
Thanks for having me, Roseanne.
Oh, it's going to be fun to talk about Louis because I'm very into the Civil War, and I know that you particularly are a Civil War historian, so I'm looking forward to the new insights you have on that event.
Fabulous.
So the first thing I'm going to ask you is, with society still fascinated by all things Civil War, even though it's over 150 years ago, how does Louis fit into that story?
You know, it's interesting because I think we imagine that the American Civil War is, of course, a fundamentally quintessentially American thing. And one of the things we don't know is how many immigrants fought in the war. And the fact that Louis came here and chose to fight in the Civil War and chose to fight for the Union, and that there were a lot of Italian American men like him, is it one of those unknown facts of the American Civil War.
Oh, I love that. Of course I love that because I'm Italian, but I also love that because we don't think about the immigrants.
No, we don't.
So what made him choose to do that?
You know, it's really hard to know. I chased that. He never said. He fought in the First War of Italian Independence, and he cared about self-determination and slipping the rule of tyranny when he got, and he was a kind of a professional military man, so he got himself in trouble at military school. I think he had an affair with a commanding officer's wife.
Oh.
Yeah. Ooh, ow. So then he ran off to the Crimean War, and he fought there for the English. And then he came back, and he was at odds, didn't know what to do. He was a second son. So he immigrated to America, where it went very badly for him. He couldn't find jobs. There was an immense amount of anti-Italian and anti-immigrant impetus out there. So he ends up in the army, kind of, because that's what he knows how to do.
Makes sense. And he chose the Union Army because he happened to be in New York?
Well, you know what? Probably won that because immigrants came. Immigrants rarely went to the American South. I don't know. I think it was a choice given on the fact that he fought in the Crimean War and he fought for Italian independence, that he had friends who fought with Garibaldi. I think this is a guy who took ideas about liberty and equality fairly seriously.
So with that in mind, why do you think Louis matters to us today? Why should we know his story?
I gotta tell you, I went into this thinking that he was a scoundrel. I mean, he is not one of the more famous people, but any of the sources that you find on him, from Wikipedia to some of the Civil War books or books about Italians who fought in the Civil War, books about him as the first director of the Met, there's a lot of negative stuff about him for a bunch of reasons. And I think why he's important is this is a guy who, by any standard, should be more famous. He won the Medal of Honor. He was a prisoner of war. He fought. He came to this country and volunteered to fight on the side that ended up not only winning, but morally correct. He went off and was a diplomat. He did a lot of really important things. He tried to come down on the right side of things. And I think he ends up with a bad reputation, one, because he's an Italian-American, and two, because we changed our ideas about archaeology, and he becomes like a lot of those guys who went out archaeologing in the last half of the 20th century. He becomes kind of a whipping boy for the fact that we changed the rules.
So how did we change the rules?
Rich guys who went off to Egypt and rich, and some rich women too, went off to various and sundry places and then engaged in what we can only call rape and pillage archaeology. But that's the way everyone was doing it. And so now, for example, Louis did that in Cyprus. And then that's how he got the job at the Met. He kind of bribed the people, like, if you hire me, I'll give you my huge collection. And now the Met's really embarrassed about the collection because it was taken from Cyprus illegally. He made a mess and left a mess, digging the stuff up and taking it away. And they hide the collection. It's in the basement somewhere. And now we're supposed to think he that all the people who did it that way were bad, but it was just how things were done then. I'm not saying you approve of it, but we changed the rules.
True, and then we're judging someone by new rules.
Also, I think because he was an Italian-American, if you think about New York in the late 1800s, we're talking robber barons, the Gilded Age, those guys who had, you know, who had 68-room cottages as summer houses. And here he was, this upstart Italian immigrant without a ton of money. They were always kind of scrambling. I don't mean they were poor and hanging out in Five Points, but not immense money. And I think there was sort of a notion that he was an upstart, that he was an overreacher.
Which sounds a lot like Alexander Hamilton in the play.
Yeah. It's also quintessentially American. He's a self-made man. I mean, he grew up in a fairly well-off family, but the family didn't have any money. They had titles, but no money. They were land rich and money poor. He was a second son. There was nothing for him there. He had to go off to the military and earn his own keep.
And that's generally something that we respect, and yet at that time period, you're right, they were judging him by how he didn't fit into their society.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's so sad.
And a really good example of that is he was a colonel in the cavalry, and by all intents and purposes, he was an immensely talented cavalry officer. He was a colonel because he had charge of this size of a unit, and that if you went up the next bigger size of unit, then you got to be the brig general. So if you were in charge of a regiment, you were a brigadier general. He did that a couple of times during the war and never got the promotion to brigadier general. He got stuck at colonel, and it always really bothered him. And he actually chased that promotion after he retired, I think not because it meant anything except he was going to force them to recognize that an Italian-American could be a brigadier general. That he'd done the job and that they were darn well going to give him the title.
Oh, I love that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I think he irritated people doing that. But
I can believe that easily, sadly. So what would you say were the burning questions of his day that occupied him and that were things he wanted to work towards fixing or being involved in, being a part of, besides the war?
Well, I think for the first half of his life, it was very much Italian independence. I mean, you had Italy was essentially in a stranglehold with the Habsburg Empire and ruled by people who weren't Italian or didn't have Italy's best interests at heart. So was really interested in the Italian independence movement. And I think he probably would have been one of those guys who stayed and fought all the way through, because there's three wars of Italian independence. And there's lots of moving back and forth. And he was particularly suited to that because he came from the Piedmont area, which was one of the leaders of this independence movement, the Piedmontese army. And I think when he left, it's because he lost his place in the army because he'd been
in trouble.
Naughty, as young men are wont to do. And so then I think he went looking for some place else where he could express this burning desire for regular people to have power. And I really think that's why he ended up in the United States then, because he could have gone anywhere. A lot of Italians went to England, especially in that class location.
Exactly, in South America.
Yeah, yeah. And instead he came to New York 2 years before the war, when pretty much everybody understood it was coming.
Interesting. And so did he interact with any other well-known Italian-Americans who happened to be in New York at that time?
You know what he did? He interacted with a lot of abolitionist-type people. Uh-huh. And not people that anybody today would be able to name, because I think today, what can we name? We can name Harriet Tubman, we can name Frederick Douglass.
John Brown.
Yeah. But people that if you were a Civil War historian, if you did the history of slavery or abolition, people you'd know. So he knew people in New York, in New England, that with tremendous sway in the abolition movement. It was hard for him to get a position in the army because he's an unknown guy and they weren't just going to dump him into the officer corps, but he certainly wasn't going to enlist as a regular guy because he had expertise and probably a sense of himself as being more important than that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to hang out a lot with the Italian-American community. And we have to remember that before the Civil War, there isn't a very big one in New York. It's
Correct.
Really after the Civil War, there's ends up there'll be a Garibaldi brigade and or an Italian brigade in the Civil War, but he's not in that brigade for reasons I'm not clear about.
Well, that speaks to the concept that researching people who didn't leave behind tons of papers, mm-hmm. or there's not that much material. So it makes me wonder about the concept of what kind of research were you able to do? What sort of things did you find?
The cool thing about history is even if you have somebody you know a ton of stuff about, there's all these things you can't know, that you never know. I mean, you think about like the most basic things about you. You know, what's your favorite flavor of tea? Do you like pie or cake? Those things all elude the historical record. So even people you know a lot of things about, say Thomas Jefferson, the most well-documented human being ever, maybe. Well, no, Lincoln. But Louis, yeah, there's not a lot. There's no, like, letters. There's no, like, special collections with his papers.
Wow.
So what there is there's people wrote about him. And it's one of the reasons that he worked really well as an historical novel, because like I could know kind of where he was at moments and times. Just figuring out who he was with in the Crimea was a huge, I spent days on that. And you might think, well, not you, but other people might think, oh, days, big deal. But if you're an historian and you put your glare on something for more than 2 hours, you've really... really gone all out. And I spent days trying to figure out, because the sources were like, well, he was in this regiment. No, they weren't there. He was in that regiment. No, he wasn't there. For a while, I thought he was with essentially the cavalry unit that had engaged in the Charge of the Light Brigade, because the source said he was there.
Uh-huh.
And then it turns out none of the sources had it right. And the only reason I found out, the thing I found is right, is because multiple sources said his commanding officer was this guy. So then you just had to chase that guy. And the records are spotty.
Especially from a war far away from another continent.
Yeah, a Crimean war with the irregular troops. We're not talking the regular British army. Turns out it was an Italian expeditionary force, but it wasn't official Italian. It was something some guys put together kind of off the cuff. It's amazing how difficult it was to find out sort of basic stuff. And so sometimes you had to make stuff up, and sometimes you had to take your best guess. Like, I knew he was in cavalry school, I didn't know which one, so I found the one that seemed to be the most famous cavalry school of its time. It was kind of in the same region that he grew up in. Yeah, it was probably that, but there's no records for that school. It's been gone for years, and if there are records, they're in Italian.
True. That's one of the problems of historians, if you try to work outside of your own country,
right.
Language issues.
Yeah, my second language is German, which is not at all helpful.
Oh, that's so funny. Cool. Well, speaking of the concept of it being a historical novel, that always makes me want to ask, is there a scene that you, of course, completely concocted, that you enjoyed writing very much, and for what reason? Why did you enjoy that bit?
The battle scenes were so much fun to write, because this is it's every writer's dream. Battle scenes and fight scenes are really fun to write. And he was in the cavalry, so there's sabers, and there's horses, and there's, you know, charging in. There's all these heroic stuff. So those were really, really fun to write. And the cavalry horses were war horses, so they have their own particular training. So I had a horse that I invented, because he would have had that, some war horse. And I gave it a name, and so I could describe what it did. So that was really fun. The other thing that was really fun, I hate to say fun, but it was. I mean, I couldn't wait to get to the chapter. He was taken prisoner. I know this sounds so awful. He was taken prisoner of war. And he was in one of the most notorious prison warehouses in Richmond, Libby Prison. He was in Libby Prison for 9 months. It was, I've been studying that for years. I've been a Civil War historian for 15, 20 years. It was really fun to take all the stuff I knew about Libby Prison and write about it. Like, I just knew off the top of my head that the officers were upstairs and the enlisted men were downstairs. And I knew that they had a little newspaper, and I knew they had a little logo that had a flea. And it was bite or be bitten was their motto. And I couldn't wait. And I was like, okay, you have to write up to there. You can't just leap ahead and write the the Libby prison.
That's fascinating.
That was oddly fun to write.
So a prisoner of war camp had a newspaper.
Well, you had these guys. This was Libby prison was actually a tobacco warehouse in Richmond, and it was one of the very first places that the Confederacy had made no provisions for. Well, what do we do when we catch dudes? So they converted some tobacco warehouses into these prisons that, of course, you know, were horrifying because there wasn't appropriate sanitation and et cetera, et cetera. So you had these guys in there for a long time. That was the place. There was a sort of famous thing in the Civil War during the first Battle of Bull Run, and all the people from Washington go out in their carriages to watch the battle. Oh, no, oh, no. Hmm. And one of the congressmen, Congressman Eli, was captured. Well, Eli was in this place. So they had these kind of big shot people there. And if anybody, it wasn't like they were later in the war, and people like Andersonville or Belle Island, which are just these people just dumped outside in stockades, just left in the weather. This was a place where they had, you know, they were inside, there were some beds, there were regular meals. It was more organized. The Confederacy hadn't fallen apart yet, because it's halfway through the war, they were still doing okay with their prisoners. Not great, but okay.
Wow.
So anyway,
that's fascinating. I love that idea. It's sadly reminiscent of people in Japanese internment camps who ran newspapers to keep track of what people were doing and sort of to give a normalcy to their life.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Well, that sounds fun. I know battle scenes are quite a good thing to write.
Oh, my goodness. It's like writing a fight scene. So much fun.
So what would you say was your favorite fact about him that you found while researching?
That I liked him. It sounds dumb. I totally expected to be writing a scoundrel, and I thought that's part of the reason I was intrigued by him, because scoundrels are just far more interesting than nice people. Let's all be honest. How do I write him so he's sympathetic? Because all the sources made him sound like kind of a jerk. And the more I wrote him, the more I thought, you know what? That anti-immigrant, anti-Italian stuff, that's not just talk. I think that stuff's real. This guy's not only not that bad, he's kind of a nifty person. And I began to like him, and then I began to admire him. And that was, I had not predicted that at all.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. What was part of that? Was any of that connected to his work with the Metropolitan Museum? What was he known for in terms of building that institution?
Well, you know, it was really, the Metropolitan Museum, he was the consul. He wasn't the ambassador to Cyprus, because they didn't have an ambassador. They had the consul. So he was in Cyprus, and actually he did some interesting things in Cyprus, and that's where I start to get slightly better records, because Louis kept track of everything he did, and then he published a book about his years in Cyprus and about these archaeological digs, because he wanted to be taken seriously as an academician and as a professional archaeologist who actually kept better records than, say, the guys who dug up Tutankhamun's tomb. He kept pretty good records. One of the things he did is he kept track of, like, the way he dealt with the locals. He didn't treat, you know, these white guys who went out on these archaeology things, they stood around and, you know, got waited on by the locals, and the locals did all the digging and all the sifting and all of that, and then you said, oh, look what I found. He seemed to treat his workers pretty well. He was super hyper-conscious of the fact that these people deserved a living wage. One time, the local officials tried to take some of these guys away, and Louis went, you know, to bat for them. No, you can't do that. You can't put these guys in jail. He seems to have made an effort in Cyprus to be a decent imperialist. I mean, it's imperialism. But he seems to have been, it's like the kindler, gentler imperialism. At a time, and I know how that sounds too, but it was at a time when most people weren't bothering. It was a, you know, let's treat the natives like inferiors. The museum stuff, that's really interesting, but I think by the time I got there, I was getting close to the end of the story, and I just don't think museums are that interesting. And the Met has this immensely long, there's a ton of history on the Met. The book was aimed at young adults. I think the stuff that was really interesting was him charging around on a horse, him having a real life love affair with his wife, him going to Cyprus and having this adventure in this little Mediterranean place. And the museum stuff, I kind of wanted to get in and out of it.
That makes sense. Speaking of his wife and speaking of the people that were important to him in life, my question is, who do you think were his mentors in life? And second half of that is, did he mentor anyone?
I think in a lot of ways. He seems unbound early in his life. I mean, he's off in the Italian army. He's a little boy. I think he's got a general, this General Ansaldi, that he served under in the Italian Independence War, and that's who he goes to the Piedmont with. Ansaldi will die there very early on. But maybe, but again, I'm just guessing because he served under this guy twice. But he seems like a guy who, you know, for a son of the local gentry, he seems like a guy who makes his own way more than you'd think. I think I'm a guy of immense self-possession and probably immense self-confidence. And those people tend not to lean much. This guy ended up a cavalry officer. Those are the daring do devil guys. And then the mortality rate amongst cavalries was immensely high. And the Civil War was really high because for a long time they had the wrong kind of firearm. And the Union Army sent the cavalry in with sabers. And that saber's all well and nice and very cool and dashing until somebody shoots you, right? Those guys, they're not mentored. They may mentor. I mean, I know he took a lot of young soldiers under his wing and tried to protect them and move them from here to there but it's all really shadowy because, again, this stuff eludes the record.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, then I'll ask you one that's going to be easier, which is my usual final question.
Okay.
Which is, who have been your mentors in life?
I'm a self-made woman. I've never had any help. I just cackled. Oh, gosh. Hard question. Well, you, a little bit. Here's what I think. I think that people walk into your life and they help you clarify who you are. And they help you in different ways. So, for example, you and I have this professional relationship where we talk about ideas and we talk about writing and we talk about books that we've read and books we want to write, and that we co-mentor each other in the way that a good female friendship does. I don't have a lot of other female friends I've done this about that with, but some others. And then, of course, you know, one's parents. I had good parents. They didn't understand me, but I didn't come from a family where you got advanced degrees and sat around being a professor talking about ideas. Mm-hmm. But they fed me and clothed me and taught me that I could do anything. And that was pretty cool when, at the age that we are, a lot of parents weren't doing that with their kids. Their daughters.
I was going to say, with their daughters.
Daughters, yeah.
So that counts.
Oh, a lot.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org. And join us for our next conversation.